Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Elledge, and this is Skylines, the Cinemetric podcast. I have a bad habit. I have many bad habits, but the particular bad habit I'm talking about on this occasion is addressing the same question to the same politician on Twitter repeatedly, knowing full well they're probably not going to answer. And, you know, I do this partly because I kind of think it's, you know, we should be trying to get answers out of these guys, partly because the refusal to answer is often instructive, and partly just to relieve the monotony of a fairly mundane and tedious existence. But I was doing this the other week with one of the Conservatives running to be the party's candidate to be the next mayor of London in 2020, when they're hoping to unseat Sadiq Khan. And they didn't answer. I wasn't really expecting them to answer. But after a while, I got an email from their comms guy saying, you know, actually, the candidate will answer your questions. But instead of just sending a tweet, they'd really like to come on the Skylines and do that. And I thought about this and I thought, well, yeah, I mean, that would be kind of cool. But there's still three candidates on the shortlist, so I should really offer the slot to all of them. You know, I shouldn't really play favourites in internal Conservative Party elections. So I made that offer, and that's what this week is going to be about. We're going to do more than one podcast. We're going to speak to the different candidates, and we're going to hear what they've got to say about, you know, how they would run this not particularly Tory-friendly city, to give us some sense of, you know, what tone the very long election campaign we're looking down the barrel of here. It's probably going to be sort of, I've lost track of the time, it's, what, 20 months to go, something like that, before the next mayoral election. So that's a long time that whoever the Tory party picks is going to be throwing rocks at Sadiq Khan. So I thought it was kind of a good moment to kind of get a sense of the election. I'm not going to do them all in one episode, but the party selection is underway very shortly, so Before they pick their candidate, I thought I should really get these out. So we're going to put them all out this week. So in alphabetical order, let's do this. First up, we have Sean Bailey. If you're not aware of him, he grew up in a Jamaican family in North Kensington. He first came to prominence about 10 years ago as one of David Cameron's A-listers, the hand-picked candidates that Cameron hoped would showcase a new, more diverse Conservative Party in the run-up to the 2010 election. That didn't really work out very well for many of the people on that list. Bailey himself stood for Parliament in Hammersmith that year and lost to the Labour Party. But, you know, he stuck around. He became David Cameron's special advisor on youth and crime, and in 2016 was elected to the London Assembly. In 2017, he stood for Parliament again in Lewisham, West and Penge. He failed to get elected again, but now he's running for mayor. So, let's hear what he's got to say. Over to Sean. Okay, you might have gathered from that we do not, in fact, have an interview with Sean Bailey. Sadly, the great man is far too busy to talk to little old us. So while we will be hearing from his rivals for the Conservative mayoral nomination, Sean Bailey sent his apologies. I will continue to push for that, but in the meantime, you'll just have to make do with the strains of Kevin MacLeod's Casa Bossa Nova.
Thank you.
enough mucking around, at least for the moment. We did, as they say, we did manage to get actual interviews with the other two candidates. So, first up, we have Andrew Boff. He's a former leader of Hillingdon Council, a former councillor in Hackney, and he's also a bit of a veteran of this particular contest. He sought the Conservative mayoral nomination four times now. This is his fifth, so he sought it in 2000, 2004, 2008, and 2016. He even, last time around, he actually made the shortlist, so perhaps this is going to finally be his year. Well, he's been a very visible figure on the London political scene for a long time as a member of the Greater London Authority, and he, you know, as you'll hear from the conversation we're about to have, he thought a lot about policy, which is, you know, to be fair, what we like around here. So, let's have a chat with Andrew. Okay, if we could start with one of the policy areas that's probably most important to many people listening to this will be housing. How do you see the housing situation in London as it stands?
Well, it's in crisis and has been for some period, and these are the symptoms of successive governments not investing in housing or not allowing investing in housing over the past 30-odd years. And so all the symptoms of that, the very high rents that there are, the lack of availability of what people call affordable housing, and the availability of homes that people can buy, all down to just not building. And we haven't had policies in the past that have been particularly friendly to those people who want to develop. And we need more people developing. It's as simple as that. We need more people wanting to get in the business of providing housing. And that's the kind of change that I want to put into place if I'm elected mayor.
So let's unpack that a little bit. There are a number of different problems that kind of get bundled together as this thing we call the housing crisis.
There's a lot of separate markets that people call the housing markets. Yeah, and it's actually lots of separate ones.
We talk about the fall in ownership numbers. Yeah. There's the poor quality of a lot of private rental stuff. There's this difficulty of getting hold of social housing. Do any of those strike you as a particular priority, or would you be more sort of focused in just kind of like trying to improve supply and hoping to address all of those that way?
Well, I think that we've got ourselves very confused over what affordable is, and I think the very word affordable I sometimes think should be banned from the English language, because to many people it means absolutely nothing. It doesn't represent homes that they can afford. I'm very keen on reintroducing, for example, council housing, which is so gone out of fashion because of the policies of successive governments and not enabling local authorities to sell the proceeds of things like right to buy. So I am going to use some of the housing funds to assist the boroughs to start a whole new programme of council housing. I think it's the best form of social housing. And I think it needs to be high quality. And when I say council houses, I tend to mean houses, because any emphasis, as far as I'm concerned, is on relieving overcrowding. As you may know, there are 350,000 young people being brought up in overcrowded conditions in London. Mm. That has really poor effects upon their educational outcomes, their health. And we need to resolve it. And that's why I find it slightly astonishing that the current mayor has abandoned any targets for building the larger family homes in order to resolve overcrowding. So larger family council houses will be a priority of mine. But that's just the social housing market. If we're talking about homes to buy, we need to make more homes land available. We need to make it easier for developers to develop. And there's a number of things we can do there. Top of the list is to make it easy for developers to understand what their obligations are going to be. At the moment, as you know, if you want to do a large development in London, there is a wrangle about the number of affordable homes that you have to provide. Sadiq Khan has set a political target of 50%. Actually, I think that gets in the way of people wanting to develop homes in London. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace that. I'm going to seek to replace that with a fixed levy that there will be on the gross development value of the project, a percentage. I don't know. Don't push me on what that percentage would be, because it's going to be a levy, and it's 2 years away from till it happens. What that will do is it will mean that developers suddenly have complete certainty as about what their obligations are. And that levy then can then go towards the local housing programs of the council. And the council can choose to do a number of things with those. I would like them to build council houses. They might want to buy into that existing development. It just makes it easier to develop. And this is one of the problems that we've had in London, is that so many developers think it's not worth their while.
So to be clear, there'd be like a bit of top slice which would go to the council responsible for the, which is basically the planning authority here.
Yes. Pretty much. That's the usual thing that will happen. And obviously there's different configurations of that depending on the kind of site. But it's about providing certainty.
What about the GLA itself? Because in sort of the glory days of council housing in London, the GLC and before that the London County Council were actually fairly major developers in their own right, weren't they? Do you see a role for London-wide government getting back into this?
I'm not unsympathetic to that, but I'm more sympathetic to doing that in partnership with the boroughs. And as I've said, I will financially assist those boroughs who wish to do council housing, because, of course, there's still too many rules around, you know, what you can't build, the amount that you can dedicate to building council homes. I will help them out because I was born in a council house. I know what the value of those homes is in terms of providing people secure housing, alleviating social need, and indeed providing for social mobility. And all those things, as far as I'm concerned, are a core to what a Conservative programme should be if I became mayor.
Can we talk about the land question?
Yes.
Because as I understand it, I think I'm right in saying you're opposed to greenbelt development.
Absolutely, 100%, yeah, not an inch.
I couldn't recall reading something specific, but yes, most people are. You're not keen on high rises. You've talked about, you know, the importance of your own front door and the Create Streets model and so on.
Yes.
And also you want these larger family homes.
Yes.
Where are we going to put this? I mean, like, on the most basic level, without sort of defying the laws of physics or opening the doorway to another dimension or something, where are we going to put these new homes?
Well, you can always pile people on top of each other if you think that's a resolution to housing problems. You can provide warehousing for families, or you can provide homes for families. I rather like the idea of people being able to be housed in homes that they love and homes that they want to live in, rather than homes that somebody has told them they have to. And that, so on.
But forgive me, this is restating your desired ends rather than the means to get there.
I'll
How
the
are you
means.
Going to do that?
I'll do the means. And that, first of all, we've got to change the political target. Currently, the political target is about the number of front doors you build. And that then means that you're getting smaller and smaller properties in order to meet those political targets. I want to change that to the number of bedrooms that are built. I need to persuade government on this as well, about these changes of targets, because I'm not interested in a front door. I'm interested in places where people can live. And London needs those larger family homes. Whichever way you look at it, if you build a larger family home, you're going to end up, because of the churn, as people readjust to their new living environments, you kind of get a free one-bedroom flat at the end of the process, because somebody who was overcrowding that has then been able to move elsewhere. Nobody actually wants tower blocks, apart from those people who want to look down on other Londoners. You know, the people who are in the penthouse, they're not particularly popular amongst Londoners who have to look at them. They've got incredibly high maintenance costs. The service charges for them are extreme. And we haven't yet seen what the lifetime of a residential tower block is in London. Now, you know, that sounds like I've got a real downer on tower blocks. I certainly have in the wrong place. And I am saying that there probably are five areas in London where they work. If you stand, you know, if you go high up in Paris and have a look at the vista there, it's a much more organized one than we've got here. If you basically low rise until you get to Île-de-France, and then you see the high buildings. Well, we can do that
rise
in
London, though. It's still Paris. It's 5, 6, 7 stories. London is 1, 2, 3.
Absolutely, I'm not opposed to some of those initiatives that want to take, add an extra story, say, on properties in central London. And that's something that London First have put forward before, and filling in the airspace, if you like, you know, of central London. And I believe they said, actually, I'm guessing here, I think they said it was about 40,000 properties you could get by just putting 40,000 homes you could get just by building on top of those existing ones.
That's about 8 months' supply, though. That's not very much.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No. Anybody comes here and says I'm going to solve the entire problem with one thing, they're a charlatan and kick them out. You know, there have got to be a number of initiatives taking place, a number of things taking place in order to resolve it. For example, one of the very small ones, but it's still something I'm very keen on. We talk about land value. There's tons of bits of land that are in the ownership of TfL and the GLA and the police that you could actually put a few homes on. It's not going to solve all of London's housing problems, but it does may be able to solve problems for, say, some self-builders who find themselves being able to afford perhaps the 160,000 it costs to build their own home, but they can't anywhere near support the value of the land. So what I'm saying is that TfL, if you can get planning permission for any tiny piece of land that TfL isn't currently using, then you can build on it and you can do your self-build, and you only have to part with the value of the land when you subsequently resell it. That gives the prospect of young families being able to bring their families up in London in a home that they've built for as little as £160,000. These are small initiatives, but they're initiatives that say we can do it. There's got to be plenty of things taking place. And also, I actually do think that the resolution of the South East's housing problems is not really helped by the political footprint of the GLA not being the same as the economic footprint of the GLA. We have to look to building on land outside London. And I've suggested about 40 garden cities to be developed around London to provide perhaps 10,000 homes each, places where people can live and work, which are good, active, attractive communities, not just dormitories, not just places to put London's problems, but actually places people can live. And for that, London will stump up some of the contribution towards transport infrastructure that makes those work.
Again, though, this is outside the GLA's current boundaries, right? I mean, am I right in thinking you also push the idea of a larger GLA?
Yeah, yes, I am. I mean, in a lot of these problems, you don't do on your own. You know, you don't solve so many of these problems on your own. You have to be in partnership with other people. We have to be in partnership with the counties that are around London, with the home counties, with the government, with local authorities. Everything is about partnership and teamwork. The job of the mayor is to push those programs forward and to use the mayor's position in order to get these people working together, because housing is at crisis. It's as simple as that. And we are not going to resolve it if we just go for the tried and tested old ways of providing housing. And, you know, politics has really got in the way. I'm a great one for politics. I believe in politics. But some of the political targets have really got in the way of solutions to housing problems in London.
I want to move on from housing in a second, because sure. I could probably talk about this all day.
Well, I could.
Yeah,
I could.
This is what I mean. This is a real danger. We just like to 3 hours
this,
on
I've
the
been doing
policy.
This for 10 years, talking about housing on the Assembly and the different ways it can be solved. So, you know, I'm happy to go on, but I think your listeners will probably want to move there.
One last thing before we leave housing, though, is probably a significant number of the people listening to this who live in London will probably be in private rental accommodation.
Yes.
What would you do for them?
Well, we need to. I think there's something to be said about the standards of rental accommodation in London. And I would certainly push for the local authorities to behave the right, for example, to be able to find landlords who aren't providing the basics of rental accommodation. So, for example, if the hot and cold, you know, there's no hot water going for a period of time, or there's something unsafe, there's health issues with the flat, that they should be able to get fixed penalties for doing those basics. Local authorities already have quite a few rights to be able to warn landlords about poor quality housing, but there are some things that are missing. I do think the local authority, because this is a local authority function, you know, you can take it all on the GLA if you want, but this is a local authority function, and we need to remind local authorities that some of them are really not doing their job with this regard, and we need to attract more investment into private private rental, you know, things like the Qatari Diaz scheme over in on the Olympic Park, on Queen Elizabeth Park. We need more of that, and more of that is coming, curiously enough. So I'm not saying anything new there, but we should be open to those continuing. But just, you know, the elephant in the room, if you ever talk to a Labour politician, you know, if we had a Labour politician here, would be rent control. Simply no. you might be able to control rents prior to the building of a scheme and have something mandated in advance, and a lot of local authorities are in advance negotiating with private rented organizations, provided privately rented accommodation, to provide sub-market rents. But what you can't do is impose from outside rent control. You just talk to any of the experts. We know that if you speak to, for example, Christine Whitehead from the London School of Economics, who's a bit of a housing who knows her housing stuff. She came to the London Assembly Housing Committee when we were talking about rent control, and she basically agreed with the phrase, rent control only works where you don't need it. It has the perverse symptoms of actually forcing up rents and reducing the quality and reducing the number of people who are being housed. So really encourage privately rental schemes, and we want the renters' rights to be recognised, and they should be enforced by local authorities, but certainly not rent control.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Let's move on and talk about... I think one of the themes that's emerging in your campaign, and indeed the campaigns of anyone who's trying to lay into the current mayor, Sadiq Khan, at present, is law and order and the rise in violent crime. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? Tell us why do you think that's such an important issue at the moment?
Well, it's an important issue because the people in London think it's an important issue, and very many feel as though the police have lost control of the streets. And we have to work on...
Or is this just a thing there that's being reported... No. By politicians trying to get them to talk about this.
You know, I've been going around London over the past few weeks as a part of this program, as a part of this selection process. And yes, that's exactly what they think. People have actually changed travel plans because they now perceive the streets as being unsafe. And it's all very well people in position saying, oh, they're just being alarmist and it's only a small percentage and all the rest of it. But the perception of policing is a very important part of policing. The perception of safety is a very important part of policing. So we've got to restore that. I mean, I would hope, you know, it's 2 years away before I'll be mayor, but I hope the mayor does something in the meantime. But he's being particularly unjoined up about it. If this is, it's not also about just increasing police numbers. You know, if increasing police numbers is the solution to violent crime, then we might as well increase the number of ambulances in order to solve road accidents. That's not the relationship. We need more people involved in detecting and alerting authorities to violent behaviour. We need to smash the gangs. And there's tried and tested ways of doing that. In Scotland, they treated the violence there, which was the most violent country in Europe at one point, they treated the violence there as a public health emergency. Then they pulled all the agencies together in order to work that. So social services, NHS, local councils, the police, voluntary organisations, even road sweepers, pulled together to meet this objective of reducing violence, identifying where violence has become part of the vocabulary, identifying those people and signposting perhaps young people into apprenticeships, to better jobs, to some kind of sporting activity, to an alternative to the violent activity they were doing. Now, I ran a youth club in Hackney for a number of years, right in the middle of an area of Hackney that was known as very much under gang influence, the London Fields Boys, as they were called at the time. And you could tell there that the outlets for some young people, they only saw gang activity as they effectively saw those gang members as their families. And they didn't see any other activities, any other options to being involved in gang activity. So we have to address that. But you're only going to address that with all the agencies working together. I'm not going to start creating youth clubs from the GLA. I'm going to start working with local authorities to ensure that they have the kind of provisions in place and we have the communications to solve this stuff. But this comes with a heavy price. And the heavy price is some very tough policing of the gangs. It does require an increase in stop and search because it makes people feel safe. But it's the kind of stop and search for which there is public consent rather than stop and search for which there is public resentment. So it is a very important subject.
That's quite a fine distinction, isn't it? I mean, how do you ensure that's the kind of stop and search with public consent?
Constant training. And I've seen, you know, in my time in Hackney, I've seen stop and search take place amongst some of the lads that used to be part of our youth club. And say, may I say, I've seen some good examples and I've seen some pretty shocking examples. And it's all down to the professionalism of the officers and the training that they've had. But stop and search, you know, when you know people are walking around the streets with knives on them and with acid on them, and then you say, well, we don't want to stop and search because it might ruffle a few feathers. I'm sorry, that's not good enough. You have to use the tools that the officers, or rather officers, have to use the tools available to them in order to keep people safe.
But it's seen as, one of the reasons it's sort of seen as so problematic a policy is because there are these sort of racial undertones to the way it's used, aren't there?
And we need to address that.
And there always have been, going back decades, of the SUS laws in the 80s.
Sure, it's not, sure.
How do you get around that problem in such a way that you don't damage the trust of the community?
Well, because you do it with the community, because it's often those communities who suffer most from the violence that's taking place. So you have to police with the people, not against them. I must say, in some parts of London, I've seen it where the police have become like a kind of hit squad, you know, from outside the area coming in and then, you know, what they see as tough policing with stop and search. Actually, that's probably not the best way. But as I say, I've seen it done very respectfully, very politely, and always been on the basis of protecting people from danger. So it can be done. It's not impossible.
A lot of what we're talking about here, like in terms of both like the, you know, cuts in police numbers and, you know, the decline of like youth services and so on, this is not specific to London, is it? This is just austerity.
Well,
is the London mayor really empowered to address a problem that was, let's be honest, created by a national government?
Well, the London mayor, I know this excuse, and it's Khan's excuse. To be fair, it's the excuse of most Labour politicians when you put them under pressure.
He hasn't made this up.
It's not my fault.
The cuts were real.
Hold on. It's not my fault. It's all the government's fault. Now, that's fine. He may have that opinion, and we could always do with more money. Who couldn't? But if that's an excuse for not doing anything, I would submit that he should make way for somebody who wants to do something with the resources he's got. And one thing we do know about police officers at the moment is they spend an awful lot of their time sitting behind desks filling out forms. I want to see them out on the street giving people reassurance that the police are there for them. And the way to do that is to provide more admin support, effectively PAs for PCs. And that's something I'll be pushing for. I also happen to think that we've neglected the contribution that PCSOs make to keeping Londoners safe. And often PCSOs can go places police officers can't. I remember speaking to some of our lads in the youth club who would never dream of speaking to a police officer, quite frankly, especially those that are involved in gangs, never dream of speaking to a police officer. They were much less reluctant to speak to a PCSO because they knew the PCSO couldn't arrest them. And that developed, that meant that you got that interaction with some young people who otherwise we wouldn't have been connecting with.
So I should specify for anyone who doesn't know, PCSO is Police Community Support Officer, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's one of those FLAs, four-letter acronyms. Sorry about that.
Let's do transport.
Okay.
So as we record this, the great tragic news broke quite recently that Crossrail is going to be delayed by a year. So you know, everyone in the London transport community is probably wearing a black armband at the moment. But if you were mayor, what would your transport priorities be?
I think tragedy is the wrong word. You want to use the word for tragedy that isolated for used for things that were unexpected. I mean,
the best tragedies are horrifically inevitable from the start.
Yeah, well, that's possibly Shakespearean. Yes, well, fair enough. I'll accept. I'll accept that correction. It's just that, you know. This actually is a proof to one of my policies that has been lampooned by some others, and that is I want to split up TfL. And people say, well, why would you want to split up TfL? Because, you know, surely it's much easier to hold it to account if it's one big organisation in one place. Well, no, actually, this is proof of the pudding, is that I fear that the pressures of the operational arm and the funding of the operation arm actually resulted in people being forthcoming about the prospects of meeting that December opening time for Crossrail. I think that TfL does need to be broken up. It's far too big. You know, the rumour is that the Mayor of London runs TfL. I think actually the opposite is probably true. And we need to get to grips with it. So I will split it out. The infrastructure side of it will report directly to me, separately from the operational side. And we'll start to see then some kind of traction. But let's not forget what a disaster Crossrail is. It's not just a tragedy, it's a disaster. There will have been people, small businesses, taking out leases around those stations on the anticipation of it opening in December. And getting the footfall from that, they won't be getting that footfall for 9 months. It's disastrous for some of those. It's disastrous for all the other people who are anticipating, whose business was anticipating that December opening. I actually think there's grounds here for legal action, either against TfL or Crossrail. Only in June, TfL came to the London Assembly and reassured us that they would meet the December deadline. They were quite certain about that. Despite the fact that in February we had said to them, do you think there's some risk? We were concerned that there was some risk of this slipping. And for something to slip with a year to go, I can understand. For something to slip with 3 months to go, I just absolutely cannot understand why that's the case. So I think we need to interrogate this a lot more than it's been looked at the moment.
But these things do slip, don't they?
They do slip.
Crossrail has actually been unusual in how well it's been seemed to have gone.
Well, it obviously hasn't, has it? It obviously hasn't. So something has been concealed from the public about the readiness of this scheme. And I think that warrants some attention by the law. Because, as I say, a lot of people are now going to be severely inconvenienced by this. And it makes me wonder whether or not we've been hearing entirely the most honest story that we could have been hearing.
Let's move on from Crossrail and talk about what else would you want to do with the transport system?
Well, I always think that a transport system should be boring, you know, totally boring, that
You're not going to win over my listeners with that attitude.
Yeah, I know. It's not great to geeks, but it's terribly good to, you know, passengers want the idea that the same bus is going to turn at the same time, at the same day, and there's going to be no eventful incidents on their journey into work, and it should be as unnoticeable as possible. Transport should just be a way of getting to where you need to be in order to carry on your life. I think one of the things we do need to attend to is the investment in infrastructure, first of all, in transport. Because we've got the structure that we have with TfL, if TfL say you can't do it, then it doesn't happen. We have got that top-down type of approach to transport infrastructure. I want to change that because there's a couple of schemes like the extension of the Croydon tram and the extension of the DLR down to Bromley, which they've just said, no, not viable, not possible, can't do it. I actually think that we should have another way of looking at those those schemes. So in certain cases, I'll be setting up local infrastructure trusts. And they'll be staffed and they will be basically composed of local residents, the local business improvement districts, the councillors, in order to pick up these improvements, like, for example, the DLR extension to Bromley North, and work them through at a local level more than they are being worked through at TfL. And certainly the people in the Land of Borough of Bromley feel like they haven't got very far with TfL in terms of getting this scheme to some kind of preparedness. And there were financial challenges, and those local infrastructure trusts working on behalf of the mayor with the guarantor, financial guarantors of the GLA, will be able to move the project forward a lot more than if we just wait for TfL to do it. So that's in transport infrastructure. In terms of the operational side of things, we need to realise that the unions have a stranglehold over the transport system. There's a number of things I want to do that I can do, and some things I need the assistance of government for. What I can do is move over to driverless operation, and I will start enthusiastically the move towards driverless operation, first of all on the Jubilee line, which is almost driverless anyway. Incidentally, driverless doesn't mean that there is nobody on the train who's there to look after people in the event of an incident. There's always be stewards or train captains who are on board to look after the safety of passengers. But driverless operation works perfectly well in so many other places. It's madness not to proceed with it. The thing I can't deal with is to be able to effectively ban strikes on the underground. The underground is such an important service to the lives of many Londoners that I feel it's one of those areas where it should be actually illegal to strike. However, the payment back for that is that I do think that any future pay review for tube drivers should be arbitrated by a judge, and so that rather than the extensive negotiation that takes place, for those who are interested, it will be a system whereby the union's bid gets as much attention as the offer from TfL. And also on the operation of the infrastructure, I just want to see a London that's more busy, especially in South London, about bringing forward these new schemes. Because I think London is the engine of the British economy. If we can't move around this city adequately, then it's the British economy that suffers.
So we've not really talked about this cycling. Where does that fit into your vision? Are you a cyclist? Are you pro-cycling?
Well, yeah, I'm multimodal, so part of my journey here today was cycling, and I cycle most places. So that's me, but it's not all about me, curiously enough. Cycling has to fit into the transport system, and we must provide more facilities for safe cycling in London. But what's been happening over the past few years is we've had an approach by TfL which has actually resulted in a reduction of support for cycling schemes because of their rather intransigent view of residents' comments on any new routes and on any new initiatives. And I regret that. And I've been involved in a number of those whereby simple suggestions by residents for perhaps adopting a slightly different route, or perhaps a slightly different manner in which you provide the scheme, have just been dismissed out of hand. And residents are suddenly looking at some residents who were previously sympathetic to the improvement in cycling schemes and now looking at the cyclists as the enemy. Now, I don't think there is such a thing as a cyclist. There's just people who use cycles, people who use bicycles. But that's the mode of thinking at the moment, due to the manner in which TfL have introduced some of these cycle superhighways, CS9, CS11. They've all had real problems trying to get the community on their side. And if the community is not on your side, there's always going to be obstacles to these kinds of development.
I mean, of course, you know, you're as a politician seeking the votes of the public, you can't come out and say that the communities are ever wrong, but I think they sometimes are. I mean, I think in certain bits of town, not mentioning any Kensington and Chelsea's in particular, there is such intransigence that I don't think it's anything to do with how TfL is handling this.
You're going to have to leave me and take me by the hand to these places, because whenever I've been involved in any of these schemes, there has been a reasonable resident saying, this is why we want the route slightly different here. And some of them are quite reasonable. As to whether or not residents can be wrong, well, we can all be wrong. But what's very important, the residents should be heard. And sometimes it sounds as though, sometimes there's an attitude that those residents, if they don't agree with us, shouldn't be heard. That's not democracy.
We've been going quite a while, so we should be wrapping up. But just a couple of things very quickly. Your discussion with Conservative Home, you talked about ending Sadiq Khan's war on the motorcyclist, and I wasn't aware of this one. What's the war on the motorcyclist how will you end it?
The war on the motorcyclist is, prior to the election, he promised that the motorcyclist would be part of the solution to congestion in London, part of the transport matrix, if you like. And after the election, of course, now the London plan is basically saying that they don't want people to use their motorcycles. It's absolutely ridiculous, because if more people got out of their cars onto motorcycles, they would be a huge contribution to removing congestion in London, and they allow people to have mobility. There is a war against motorcyclists. It's as simple as that. You only have to read the London plan. It has a very dim view of anybody who decides to drive any kind of motorised two-wheel transport. There is a war. But I intend to ensure, one of the things I want to do is to say to those boroughs, and ask those boroughs who currently don't allow motorcycles to use bus lanes, to reconsider. It seems daft that you can take your motorbike through London and on the TfL bus lanes you can use them, and then all of a sudden it becomes a local bus lane and you can't, and then you receive a fine. That's ridiculous. We need to also have a lot more concentration on motorcyclist safety as well, and the same kind of focus that we have on cyclist safety too. These are people who are choosing to come into London or to use a form of transport that they want to use, and it's a contribution to reducing air pollution in London, not increasing, reducing air pollution in London, reducing congestion. And actually, I think they should be supported.
One other quote from the same interview I wanted to ask you about. You said you would reject Khan's thinly veiled war on the suburbs, which aims to turn outer London into inner London. What did you mean by that?
I meant that he's removing the protections for back gardens from development, which was introduced after the London Wildlife Trust warned the previous mayor about how wildlife is suffering as a result of overdevelopments of the back gardens in London. It means that he has effectively said to outer London boroughs who believe they should be building more family housing in their own plans, he's actually said, scrap that. You've got to build 60% of should be one-bedroom flats. He's encouraged the development of high-rise. He's encouraging the conversion of larger homes into smaller ones. And this is nothing short of a war on the suburbs. It is as simple as that. And it doesn't take a lot of reading of the draft London plan to come to that conclusion. I will end that war, because I love London in all its parts. And those suburbs in which I was born are as important as the inner London to which I moved, and the tourist spots that are there. It all makes up London. And we are going to lose that distinction if the draft London plan has the benefit of a second Khan term.
I mean, there is a danger. This sounds like, developers are going to be stealing people's back gardens in the middle of the night. That's not... That's not where we're going. It's like, it's about opening up opportunities, surely.
It's about stealing people's back gardens in the middle of the night. Well, no, it's not stealing their back gardens. No, no, your neighbour, your neighbour will be only too happy to sell their back garden to a developer. And that the effect that that has on your quality of life, they will be only too happy. And the only thing protecting you against that neighbour who wants to take the money and run is currently the protection in back gardens. It's a really, talk to anybody involved in life, in wildlife corridors, the green cover in London, which is really important to us. And we're losing it at a rapid rate in outer London.
One last thing to wrap up. I think London electorate does seem to have swung quite visibly to the left in recent years, or possibly not to the left exactly more, as we've seen with the slow motion realignment of British politics and the Tories that have become the sort of party of Brexit, for want of a better word. Labour's position in London looks more secure than it did 10 years ago. This is going to be a difficult, and you're pro-Brexit as well, aren't you? This is going to be a difficult election, surely.
I really don't think so. I mean, what we're talking about, 10 years ago, we had a huge victory in London. So 2008, we had a huge victory in London. It's not been so good recently. However, the anticipated disaster of the local elections proved not to be the disaster that everybody assumed. What we have a problem with in the Conservative Party, without doubt, is that we have an enterprising, forward-looking, liberal electorate who articulate everything that the Conservative Party is about. And yet we have been unable to tie... And when you talk to people about those views, about our views as Conservatives, people say, yeah, I agree with that. You know, this talk to the public about, you know, the rights for Uber drivers to be able to earn a living and be enterprising. And Londoners tend to say, yeah, you know, I do think they have a right to do that. It's the socialists that don't want people to succeed. And they agree with us. And then we show them our party label. And, of course, many of them then say, oh, well, I can't support you. That's a problem for our party. It's a problem for our mayoral campaign. And it's a problem I intend to solve.
Andrew Boff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Andrew Boff, member of the Greater London Assembly and one of the three candidates on the shortlist to run for London Mayor for the Tories in 2020. We'll be back tomorrow with part two of this particular podcast, in which we're going to hear from his rival for that role, Joy Morrissey. See you then. You've been listening to Skylines, the podcast from City Metric, the New Statesman City site. It was presented and produced by me, John Ellidge. If you enjoyed the episode, then please do consider leaving us an iTunes review. It really helps other people to discover the show. And, you know, the more people get listening to the show, the sooner I can achieve my real goal of world domination for the medium of trains. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.